This is The Book and the Spade, a report on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. Here's your host, Gordon Govier.
You could say that most of what we read about in the Bible took place under the watchful eye of the Sphinx, because the Great Sphinx on the Giza Plateau just outside of Cairo predates Abraham by about 500 years, and it faces east, looking across the Nile River towards the land of Israel. The Sphinx and the Great Pyramids are not mentioned in the Bible, of course, but they're there in the background during the stories of Abraham, Joseph, Moses, and even Jesus. They all found themselves in Egypt during part of their lives in some proximity to the pyramids and the Sphinx. Egypt and Israel are inextricably linked in the story of the Bible and archaeology. Egyptology and biblical archaeology are two separate disciplines today, but our understanding of the biblical world has been shaped by the discoveries from ancient Egypt. On our last program, we began a conversation with Harvard University Egyptologist Mark Lehner about his search for the city of the man who built the pyramids. The ruins of the city certainly aren't as impressive as the Sphinx or the Great Pyramids that overshadow it, but it does have an interesting story to tell once it can be found.
Because of the analysis of the landscape and the location of the quarries, the likely location of the harbor, it seemed to me that the pyramid, the city that supported these people should be out to the south-southeast. There's a colossal stone wall out in that area, about 350 meters south of the Sphinx. It's called the Wall of the Crow, in Arabic, Hayt al-Gharab. It's about 200 meters long, and it's got a monumental gateway through it.
And had anybody ever paid much attention to it before?
There were a few articles about it. The great excavator of Giza, George Reisner, who's also known for his work in Samaria, suggested offhand that it might be, you know, the boundary wall of a pyramid city. Egyptologists knew that each pyramid had a town, so it's called pyramid towns. For the priests and people who were servicing the temples attached to the pyramids long after the pharaoh who was buried in the pyramid died. It wasn't really known if these pyramid towns grew out of the labor camps that must have been there for building the pyramids, but it was known that there were these towns. We have the titles of mayors of these pyramid towns in the tombs surrounding the pyramids. And so Reisner said, well, you know, the Wall of the Crow must be the boundary wall of some pyramid town. A few people had poked around, but not much was done, and I like to tell audiences that if it were anywhere in my home state of North Dakota, you know, they'd probably make a national park around it. But it had been largely ignored, actually, and our excavations are taking place just to the south of that giant wall.
Now, how long ago did you actually start then excavating in this area by the wall?
Well, we've been excavating there almost 14 years, more than 14 years now. We started in 1988-89, and up until 1999, that is to say, about 4 years ago, we were kind of running around different parts of the site like firemen. Our first excavation squares were down where there's a soccer field that was just given over on loan to the local townspeople just before we started digging. Then in our next season in 1991, we found these ancient bakeries where the pyramid-age Egyptians were making bread in these large pots. And we found that because a backhoe had gouged a trench through the desert and just missed these bakeries, which were intact. However, up until 1999, all our excavations were small exposures in 5 by 5 meter squares, that is to say squares about 15 by 15 feet. Sometimes they were adjacent, so we had a larger exposure. And we were digging down through this enormous overburden. The site was covered by up to 12 feet, in some cases, of sand. This sand came down very quickly over our site in ancient times. The sand is very important archaeologically because it says something about a dramatic climate shift, I think not long after the Pyramid Age. But most of the sand had been turned over on our site by the nearby riding stables. And when I went to Egypt first in 1973, there were two major stables. Now it's estimated there may be more than 90. These are stables that house horses, camels, donkeys for the tourist industry, and just general riders. Even Egyptians now are increasingly riding horses in the desert around the pyramids. So the local stables for decades have taken the clean sand from our site, put it on the floor of the stables, and then when they clean the stables, they return the sand to the site with its new inclusions. This is what we call the overburden. It's a substantial layer of sand that's been largely turned over. We had to dig down through that before we hit a very compact mud surface, which is the remains of the ancient settlement that we're excavating. the sand diggers didn't hurt that surface too much because it didn't, you know, suit their purposes. But mechanized machinery was digging trenches through the site before Dr. Zahi Hawass asked us to excavate it in the mode of salvage archaeology to see what was there. Everywhere we put down our squares, we found large walls, bakeries, what looked like workers' houses, one place where they were working copper. So something very big was lurking down there. In 1999, we started what we call our Millennium Project, where our benefactors made it possible for us to work almost nonstop over the next 3 years, between 1999 and 2002. What we found we could do was to peel the overburden off the site, and simply by scraping this, what we call the mud mass, the very compact ruins of the third millennium settlement, we could see the outlines of the walls and map it without having to excavate intensively. The reason we could do that is because this settlement, this part of a city, fell to ruin very quickly after the inhabitants were no longer using it in the time of the Giza pyramids. And then forces of erosion cut the mound that must have resulted at about waist to ankle level. So simply, it's as though you took a horizontal section through a town after it had fallen into ruins. And by just scraping the surface of the mud mass, we can actually see the outlines of the walls and map the overall architectural urban context of our bakeries, our workers' houses, and the copper, you know, working facility.
Has there ever been another city that's been uncovered quite like this?
No. There have been other urban areas, other cities that have been uncovered in ancient Egypt. For example, the great city of Tell El Amarna, where Akhenaten lived with Nefertiti and probably Tutankhamun for a while. German and British missions in the early part of the 20th century exposed basically the footprint of the Egyptian state where it stepped down and walked on after 10 years. And it's an amazing document for the study of urbanism in the Near East, in the ancient Near East. But very little had been done on Old Kingdom settlement at all, the first third of Egyptian history. Most of the excavation has been focused on tombs, pyramids, and temples. So we never really knew how the Old Kingdom Egyptians expressed themselves on the ground, except for their cemeteries and funerary monuments. We have a few exposures of Old Kingdom settlement at other sites, like Elephantina in Aswan, and in the Oases, a little bit at Abydos, the center of Osiris worship in Upper Egypt. But what we have now done at Giza is exposed and mapped an urban footprint over 5 hectares. That's 50,000 square meters. I'm sorry, I think metric after 30 years of work in Egypt.
Five hectares is about 10.5 acres, which is a pretty good-sized ancient city. 1 hectare is just under 2.5 acres. If you've just joined us, we're talking with Harvard University Egyptologist Mark Lehner about his search for the city of the men who built the pyramids. He says they have intensively excavated about 1 acre so far, 10% of the site.
And when I say we excavate intensively, we do really excavate intensively. More than most missions, even if they're not in salvage mode. We save every scrap of animal bone. We do flotation to recover ancient plant remains to understand their diet. We save every scrap of chipped stone. And we analyze all this material in order to understand something of their life ways, their economy, and their society. And the footprint of the architecture tells us something about how they were organizing the people. Now, that's what's unique. What we exposed were a series of long galleries, almost like an stretched-out railroad apartment, organized in great blocks, almost like city blocks, separated by streets that were precociously modern in their regularity. One street we've tracked for 165 meters.
So these would be like dormitories?
They look like dormitories. Every one of these galleries has a long colonnade in the front end that is on the north, or a long extended front porch. The evidence is simply a low wall about as high as your ankle and about a foot wide. But it's punctuated by holes for columns, and the column bases are still underneath. So the front ends of the galleries were like a long extended front porch. In the back ends of the galleries, we find what are clearly little houses. And in back of the houses, further south in each gallery, we have chambers divided into two or four, where there was lots of cooking, baking, and roasting. Now, each one of these galleries is 35 yards in length, so a third of a football field. And we found four great blocks of these galleries over a total length of more than 150 meters. Altogether, the site now comprises an area of about 7 or 8 football fields.
So this would be the classic bedroom community for the people that built the pyramids then?
We think so. It's an inference. But lacking hieroglyphic text that would clearly explain or label these things, we have to make these inferences. In one of the galleries that we excavated completely, we found these little low platforms that sloped slightly. And they are clearly bed platforms or sleeping platforms, such as we know from ancient Egyptian houses of other sites and later periods. And we think then that each one of these long galleries could have slept 40 to 50 people for a total of about 2,000 people in the entire gallery complex that we've now exposed. And the best we can come up with is that this is where the rotating labor force was temporarily housed, because we do know from some ancient Egyptian texts and workers' graffiti and some papyri of the Old Kingdom, we infer that much of the grunt labor was rotating in and out of the project, maybe for a month, maybe for a few months. And I could explain how we know that or why we make that inference.
I think that's a good idea. How do you know that?
Well, we have graffiti, first of all, on some of these monuments. For example, in these relieving chambers above the Great Pyramid's King's Chamber, in the Great Pyramid you have the King's Chamber, and there are low chambers that were never meant to be seen above the ceiling of the King's Chamber, and they're only about 3 feet in height. They're meant to relieve the weight of the pyramid on the ceiling of the King's Chamber. These chambers were only entered in 1836 by an Englishman named Howard Weiss, using gunpowder to blast his way through. They were never meant to be seen. Inside, he found graffiti of the workers, leveling lines, little notations, but also the names of work gangs. And one gang name can be read very clearly as the Friends of Khufu gang. Over in the third pyramid at Giza, when George Reisner excavated the temple of that pyramid in the early part of the 20th century, he found graffiti on the big limestone blocks for laying out the temple. And on one side of the temple, you had hieroglyphic in red paint mentioning the Friends of Menkaure gang, but only on one side of the temple. On the other side of the temple, you had graffiti mentioning the Drunkards of Menkaure gang.
We're talking about one of the great, largely untold stories of modern archaeology, the search for the city of the men who built the pyramids. Just exactly how the Drunkards of Menkaure gang fit into that picture will be addressed further in our next program as we continue our conversation with Harvard University Egyptologist Mark Lehner. We're discussing what has become his life's work. Egyptology is not exactly biblical archaeology, but there are strong connections there. This program was recorded in 2004. Remember, for more information on the biblical archaeology resources we offer, go to our website at radioscribe.com. I'm Gordon Govier. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next time for more backgrounders on the Bible through biblical archaeology on The Book and the Spade.
The Book and the Spade is produced by Scribe Media. For information on biblical archaeology resources or obtaining a copy of this program on CD, go to our website at radioscribe.com.